The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 21, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
Joe Fox.
Woo! I'm back after 13 episodes.
Is that how long it's been?
Yeah, that's how long it's been, 13 episodes. So, but no, happy to be back.
If you're a new listener to the show, Joe did join us for a few of our early episodes, and then I think last time we all hung out was probably play Blackpool.
Yeah. I mean, I've not had a chance to be on the show recently. Been very busy, unfortunately, doing adult things like buying houses, etc.
And getting over your hangover from
Blackpool. And getting over my hangover from Blackpool.
It's taken that long.
It took that long. I've been comatose for 2 weeks.
Well, welcome back, Joe.
Thank you.
And we did talk last week about this this poll that we're currently up for, the world's best podcast.
Yeah, and we've been getting some votes, but we need some more, guys.
Now, bearing in mind, I think at the end of the weekend last week, we had about 1,500 listens on SoundCloud alone of our last episode. We've got about 90 votes.
No, I think it was 98, I just checked.
98 at the current time.
Yeah, we're sixth, though.
Well, you know, we did do a little appeal last week, and we have made it into the top 10 already. And, you know, we do the show for free every week. We never charge for it. We never ask anything of you.
That's it.
And it'll take you a second to vote in this poll. Literally, it's one click of the mouse, isn't it?
Facebook. And even when we share it, you'll see the poll underneath. You don't need to go through a massive procedure.
Yeah.
It's just like, click.
Yeah, I've had some people commenting on the post going, I'll vote for it later. And I'm like, it's less effort to actually click the button.
Just do it now. The link's right there.
Exactly. So, you know, I'm one of these guys. I'm lazy as anything. You know, people say stuff like that. Well, I'll do it later, whatever. We'll put the link in the show notes on the retrohour.com. There is an article page on there. It's on our Facebook. We've made it dead easy to find. It'll take you a second. And, you know, just be nice to get some recognition for this show. And
and for our great guests. And talking of great guests today.
Yeah, now, well, look, I think the world's been going Amiga crazy recently.
It has, and
I haven't.
No, Joe hasn't, and he always comes on the Amiga shows as well. So.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Amiga, and every time it's like, oh, come on the show, oh, we've got an Amiga guest. Oh, all right, brilliant.
He's our singing Nintendo guy, Miss Tom Kalinske, you know?
That hangover lasted too long, Joe.
Yeah, it did.
But yeah, well, this week, obviously, there was a new movie, you know, Bedrooms to Billions.
The
Amiga Years came out on Thursday last week. 2.5-hour documentary all about the Amiga. Mm. Really interesting. It's another Amiga film that's actually due out in about a week. Viva Amiga.
Viva Amiga.
Whose guest we had on recently, the guy behind that, Zach. And we had David Pleasance on last week, ex-MD of Commodore. So, you know, everyone's really, the Amiga's back on the radar, big style right now. So this week we're going to be focusing on a very interesting part of the Amiga culture, the demo scene.
Yeah, and particularly the demo scene music. I've talked to Hoffman and got him on the show today. Hoffman's not a massive name, but he's good. I really, really love his music. And if there's anyone that's still producing mods, Hoffman's making the best at the moment. I think he may be one of the only guys producing mods in 2016.
Well, for those who are not big Amiga heads, mod is actually the name of the Amiga's music file format. And, you know, it's like the Amiga sound chip's only 8-bit, isn't it?
It's like four channels, you know.
He does some amazing stuff with that. I'm looking at his CV here. You know, he's a member of Ghost in 1992, Jewel Crew Shining, Mono, Unstable Listening, Radiance in 94, Quartz. You know, these are like the big Amiga demo groups back in the day.
He's writing his own software as well at the moment, and he's even got his own record label.
Yeah.
So this is going to be really interesting.
That's pretty good, actually.
Yeah. And was he the guy behind these Amiga deck,
PT-1210. He wrote it in assembly.
Wow, okay.
So we're going to have to ask him about that.
Because Ravi's got like two Amiga 1200s that he uses like as decks, and the software on it that essentially emulates a turntable. You can pitch bend it and all that. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can loop it, take samples out. It's amazing.
Oh, there's me pissing about on a Sega Mega Drive.
So, Hoffman's going to be on in around 30 minutes from now. A bit of a special on the Amiga demo scene. I'm just taking my coat off. It's a bit warm in here, isn't it? So let's get into this week's news then. First of all, now this is quite interesting. If you ever wanted a quite unique wallet, you can turn an Atari cart into a wallet now.
Yeah, it's like a little simple kind of hack that you can do.
You see, I thought like that sounds really cool, looks really cool. I wouldn't be able to make it myself because I'm useless, but I don't know, I could see me sitting on it and breaking it. But he does say in the video it's not good for if you're a back pocket user for your wallet. But yeah, I'd snap it, but it's definitely very cool.
I suppose you could use it to keep like SD cards in with all your Atari images, or you could use it for, you know, a little...
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be a wallet, I guess.
Oh, you'd probably stick a Raspberry Pi or something in there and have a little...
that's actually quite cool. Have that hanging out the side of your TV or something.
Yeah, just turn a whole cart into an Atari emulator.
So essentially what this guy's done, he's put a video up here, and it's Bob Claggett of I Like To Make Stuff, and he's basically hollowed out an Atari cart, and put a hinge on the back of it, and keeps all his store cards and his money in there as well. Love the fact that he actually shows he's using an ET cartridge from the Atari 2600. So, as we all know, that's probably the best use of that game.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, but making a better use of it.
Now, a classic franchise is back, and, you know, to be fair, I think there's a new Worms game comes out pretty much every 6 months.
But this time, it's been 21 years since
really
Worms.
Been that long?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes us all feel old.
So this is Team 17 are bringing out a new one, then?
Yeah, this is Worms Weapons of Mass Destruction, which looks quite nice, the multiplayer. I kind of got into Worms, did Worms DC, and then Worms Armageddon, which was the ultimate Worms for me. Later on, there was Worms 3D and stuff, but I think they kind of lost their way a little bit.
Yeah, it looks like they're trying to get back to their roots. Like, they did a few, obviously, a lot of iOS and Android stuff recently to try and get back to the originals, but this looks like they've gone really... Not back to basics, but taking it back a few steps, but yeah, for the better, if that makes sense.
It's 2D, isn't it?
There's that as well. It's 2D straight away.
That's the thing about the 3D Worms games. It always got a bit like, you know, I think it was in that stage of 3D's infancy where people just wanted to use 3D for the sake of using it, and it was a bit like, you don't actually need it in this kind of game.
Yeah, I mean, I had Worms 3D for the GameCube, and I remember enjoying it, but I think the... Looking back to it, it's one of those games which you think like, oh, it's really good, but I think nostalgia was taking over, because if it was one of those games, it was one of the first games I bought myself with my own money when I was like 13, 14. So I really enjoyed it at the time, but I've gone back to play it since and just kind of gone, oh, this is really clunky and slow.
Well, they gave one away on the Xbox One, didn't they? But I couldn't really get into that. I tried playing it a bit, and I was a bit
they
tried to give it like a campaign, didn't they? Yeah, it was just a bit like, I just want to go and kill some worms. Like,
essentially, that's what Worms is, isn't it? It's like, you know, blow hell out of the other team, and that's it, isn't it? That's all anyone wants
to
do.
It needs to be
that's
a pick up and play, like not messing around with a tutorial. And that's, I think, what happened with the Xbox One when I got bored of that, like in 20 minutes.
We were talking about the stats on this that they've posted, because we're looking at an article on Retro Gamer, and Joe made an interesting point. How are they actually receiving this stats? They're saying, you know, over 3 million worms have died.
I think that's 3 billion, actually.
3 billion.
3 billion worms have died since its launch in 1995.
Too many zeros.
And I was like, well, was it online then? But you didn't... You seem to think it was Armageddon was the first one.
I think it was Armageddon, but I remember there being Worms World Tournaments and there being, like, British champions and leaderboards, you know?
Someone was behind, like, keeping total of them all.
That would be a good job. Just, like, since the dawn of Worms, he's just kept a manual tally of every worm that's been killed.
But what is quite interesting here, it said over 70 million copies of Worms have been sold today.
That's pretty impressive.
And, you know, I think, you know, Worms originally came out on the Amiga. That was his first platform that it came out on, and it was quite late in the Amiga's life. It was like 95, wasn't it?
It was, and they had a Worms Director's Cut, which was a special Amiga version that had stuff like Super Sheep and Grandmas and all the extras.
But, you know, I knew everyone that had them, but I don't know anyone that bought them, so it's like 70 million. You could probably double that with that.
Yeah, that's true. That's 70 million paid for copies.
Yeah, exactly, So, if you want to find out about this new Worms game, it is coming out on all the current consoles, PS4, Xbox One, and PC, a little bit later on this year.
And I'll say one thing, sorry. Team 17 are doing some fabulous games at the moment. With The Escapists, that's really good, and Flockers was really good. So hopefully they'll get that goodness back into the Worms franchise.
Absolutely. So if you want more info, we'll put it on the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, there seems to be a bit of a thing recently about turning video games into movies again, which was one we mentioned the other week.
Shinobi's getting made into a movie. It makes more sense than Battleships. It makes more sense.
To be fair, if they make Battleships into a movie, you can make anything into a film, can't you?
Well, these ones sound a bit weird, but they've proposed now. Missile Command and Centipede.
I'm thinking for Centipede, it's got to be like a B-movie, you know, like a massive...
Yeah. But no, they'll probably do something like Pixels and try to make it massive Hollywood. Oh. Yeah.
Did you watch Pixels?
I saw Pixels.
What did you think?
Yeah, it was all right.
Who was that Jonah Hill ripoff?
Yeah,
he's
the voice of Olaf from Frozen. I think they're just kind of trying to push him. Let's make this guy really famous, kind of thing. It was all right. It was a good watch, but I wouldn't recommend it. Like, I wouldn't go.
Yeah, Adam Sandler films. I'm really.
Yeah, I wouldn't go shout in front of rooftops, go watch it, but it was a decent watch.
You know, the days of Happy Gilmore are long behind him, I think, aren't they? But this is quite interesting, though. So essentially what they're saying is Atari, or the company that owned the rights to the Atari franchises, have agreed a deal with a movie studio to make Missile Command and Centipede into films. Now, I think by the looks of it, they've just given them rights to the trademark and the name. There's no info on who's directing or what kind of story is going to be in there. They basically said, you can use his name.
Missile Command would just be set in NORAD. Like, fire.
But, you know, we talked when we mentioned the Shinobi thing, because we did say there's been a bit of a drought of good ninja movies recently.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s, everything was ninja films.
Yeah.
apart from the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Michael Bay one that looks dreadful.
You say it looks dreadful.
I liked it, the first one.
It is a bad film. Mm. Like, the first one was a dreadful film, but at the same time, I enjoyed it, and I'm going to go see the second one. But at the same time, it is crap. Like, the first, I just thought it was daft when she was like, oh my God, it's Project Renaissance. And it's like, how did you forget that?
it's aimed at 12-year-olds. Yeah. But
it's Michael Bay film, isn't it? Explosions everywhere in CGI.
Explosions.
we did talk, we mentioned the Shinobi thing, though, that most video games that are turned into movies end up making really bad films.
Yeah.
We couldn't really think of one that had actually made the transition that well.
Yeah, no, though. But
I'm sure there is one. I'm trying to think now.
Maybe Ghost in the Shell.
No, that was a manga first. I'm sure there is one. It's going to bug me now.
Yeah, what, Doom was awful. Tomb Raider. Street Fighter.
Super Mario Bros.
Yeah, oh, dude.
Resident Evil. Yeah. what was the what's coming out? Warcraft. Warcraft's
coming
out.
That didn't look bad, actually.
It
looked
bad
last night.
Angry Birds as well as.
Are they actually really doing Angry Birds?
It's out. It's out now.
I remember there was a spoof trailer, wasn't there, about a year or so?
Yeah, it's actually out now.
It looks really bad.
The app on my phone, which I've not played in like 3 years, has been updated to the new look, what they look like in the films. And I'm just like, they've probably changed the game as well, Ben.
but we'll keep an eye on this, obviously. But it is a couple of bizarre franchises. Those games, they had no story behind them. It was it's an Atari 2600 game, you know what I mean?
So I wonder how they tried to, like, in Missile Command, if they tried to get the controller in there somehow. So, like, in Battleship, the bullets look like the little pegs on the board game.
Yeah.
So do you think, like, in Missile Command, they'll be like, oh, yeah, the only way we can fight these aliens with these rollerball controls?
Now, that actually sounds pretty good. Yeah. Should get Joe on the case right in this film.
We've got new rollerball technology for our nukes.
You heard it here first.
I've just thought of a good one, actually. Wreck-It Ralph.
Wreck-It Ralph. That was the other way around. That was a film first and the game came out, didn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say that wasn't a game first.
That was an awesome film.
They had a few brands in there, yeah.
Great soundtrack, great film.
Now, we've probably all played ports of games that weren't really designed for the platform that we played it on. And there's an article here on there, retrogamingmag.com. It's 5 games that are too much for the hardware. Now, they're basically talking about stuff like Vortex for the Super Nintendo, Duke Nukem 3D on the game.com handheld. I've never played the game.com, but...
You don't want to.
No. Have you played one?
I've played one. My friend Richard had one when we were younger. And any sort of game, to be honest, which was a port to the game.com, the Tiger, whatever it was, TigerGame.com, just doesn't work. So, like, they're obviously on about, like, the game's hardware is too much, and obviously on about Duke Nukem, but... Mm-hmm. Resident Evil 2 was ported to that, and it's a terrible port.
Yeah.
Batman Forever, which is a terrible game anyway, was on that, but that's a terrible port of a terrible game.
Yeah, even worse.
So they're on about Duke Nukem 3D, but to be any port to that game console.
Any game on that system.
Just any game on that system.
Was it a black and white console?
It's a black and white. It's a touchscreen.
Yeah.
It came with a stylus, but it was like that early touchscreen technology.
Yeah.
Tiger were the ones that did the little LED screens, where it was just like switch before.
No, I remember.
It was a bit better than that, but it didn't work as well as a Game Boy, and it came out like 8 years after a Game Boy, so put it that way.
It was early 2000s it came out.
97.
Oh, was it 97?
Yeah, 97 I've got here.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, they also talk about Doom on the 3DO, which I think, you know, it says here, games that were too much for the hardware. The 3DO could handle Doom, no problem at all. I mean, it even got ported. It's like, we know the reasons why it wasn't a great port on the 32X. But, you know, if you look at the story behind Doom on the 3DO, essentially it was a rush port, wasn't it? It was like, you know, basically just a beta test kind of thing, and they released it.
Yeah, but they probably also just used the easiest routes, and, you know, when they got it out.
Yeah,
kind of not optimized.
But there is, I remember playing like on the Amiga, do you remember Z-Wolf?
Yeah.
And that was, it was kind of a polygon-based game, wasn't it? A bit kind of 3D. And you play it on an Amiga 500 and the frame rate was pretty slow anyway. As soon as you got some enemies on the screen though, literally you could like watch it kind of redrawing it was that slow. And I love the game, but I just thought, you know, this computer's not fast enough.
A lot of those old kind of 3D attempting games on Amiga and Atari were just 5 frames per second or 15 frames per second. It was really bad.
Well, even you mentioned here as well, I didn't even know they did. They put Dragon's Lair to the NES, apparently. Which,
That's, I'm sure the Angry Video Game Nerd.
Did he? Did a video on that?
Yeah, he did a video on that, yeah, years ago. But yeah, he did a video on that because of... It's really bad.
Yeah. Well, it's an FMV game at the end of the day.
Well, exactly. They made it into a 2D platformer, but it's like really, really slow.
There's so many ports of that game
You press jump and like 5 seconds later he jumps. Yeah. Like, it's terrible. Like,
well, of course, Dragon's Lair is on the ZX81 as well, and it's probably better than this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. From our friend Jim Bagley.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, it's quite interesting that I think, you know, a lot of the time, companies just want to get the franchise onto as many platforms as possible, and there have been a lot of instances. I mean, it used to happen more in like the 8-bit and early 16-bit days, where you go to the arcade and you play a game, and then you'd want to take it home, but it'd be nothing like the arcade because your hardware wasn't up to it.
Do you think that ruins the reputation of a system, or kind of, you know, lets people down?
Well, I always remember the key example to me was Outrun on the Amiga, which was an awful port.
Yeah,
and it's one of those that really, you know, the Mega Drive handled it fine. It was great on the Mega Drive, but it's kind of one of those where someone, I think, should revisit it now. You know, he's got some more skills and just...
You see, my first experience of Outrun was on the Mega Drive. Mm-hmm. And as a child, then playing it in the arcade, I can't remember seeing a difference. Obviously, there is a difference. But I think that's because I played it on the Mega Drive first. But if you do play an arcade game first before you play it on the home console, you definitely see the difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of like, you see it as a negative thing, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's the difference with the British home computers and the kind of American consoles, that the Americans were the arcade replica, and British were like, arcade replica, if you're lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone ported it correctly, you know.
Yeah, but even then, a lot of the time, it'd only be if a coder was actually, you know, a bit of a perfectionist and put a bit of heart and soul into it. Yeah. A lot of the time, it'd just be quick, dirty ports for quick cash, wouldn't it?
It wasn't rushed for 2 weeks.
Exactly. And this next headline was quite eye-catching, I think. Believe it or not, vinyl now makes more cash for the music industry than YouTube does.
Did you ever think you'd be saying that vinyl and cash together?
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
Well, they reckon that sales of vinyl have grown in the UK for the 8th year in a row, and that now it's only just eclipsing the money that the music industry makes from YouTube, but it's up there. So they're saying it was a bumper year for British vinyl. 2.1 million LPs were sold in 2015, raked in at £25.1 million. And YouTube, the music industry, at the BPI, are kind of their trade body, they estimated it was 24.4 million. So, you know, nearly a million more has been made off vinyl than YouTube royalties.
You see, that doesn't... Considering how big YouTube is and how much money gets thrown around, like...
Punching microphones?
Yeah, punching microphones here. In anger. How, like, big YouTube is and how big the music industry is, that seems so... small for me, 24.4 million. Like, I don't know. I always kind of, I would compare the music industry to the film industry. And then it's like these new films come out and it's like, oh, in its opening 6 weeks, it's made 800 million. Like, I can't help but think that is a really low figure.
That's what I thought when I saw it. It's not that the vinyl sales were impressive. It's that the YouTube
it's money so they pay
is, yeah, it's awful. Yeah.
Is that a figure for the national sales as well? Because here it says, you know, the British...
Yeah, BPI
sold on this.
Yeah, it's just UK stats by the looks of it.
Okay.
But I remember, I mean, there's an article here about Spotify, and I think because, you know, these kind of online services have got musicians over a barrel, really, because no one buys, you know, well, I know vinyl is now selling again, but when was the last time you bought a CD single, for example, you know what I mean? But Lady Gaga, she got 1 million plays on Spotify. Guess how much she earned off 1 million plays?
Oh, she's got to be like, I don't know, 75,000 or...
£108.
£108.
Yeah, for 1 million plays on Spotify.
I was going to jokingly say, like, oh, Turner, something.
Wow. That is crazy, isn't it? That's why a lot of musicians are now, you know, setting up their own alternative kind of services, like Jay-Z and Kanye West and stuff.
I guess if you're a musician and you wanted to do distribution, you'd say, oh, I've got these two choices, iTunes or Spotify.
Yeah.
Or and, they're free Deezer, but no one uses that.
I'll stick it on YouTube and you're not going to watch of that.
What I see a lot, like, especially in like the kind of alternative and metal scene and stuff, is so many upcoming artists and bands, they just chuck their album out for free because they don't make any money from it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think they just make a little bit of money to make the album or the single from playing shows, which is really where the money comes from for bands like that. And then they just kind of chuck it out for free just because they want people to hear it.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
or have a really nicely done item, like a vinyl or a nicely printed cassette.
Just, for you to just say then, like, Lady Gaga only made 108 quid on Spotify is just maddening. Like, that's just crazy, like, with how big she is as well. Mm-hmm. So it obviously just pays off just to kind of throw it out for free for the fans, because nobody's going to buy it anyway, because they're just going to stream it everywhere.
Yeah. And let's be honest, the music industry's always been really skank on the artist.
Yeah. Writers, isn't it, who get most of the cash. But I think, you know, like you said, it's a touring, isn't it? I mean, Lady Gaga, she's constantly on tour.
Yeah.
And if one of the biggest artists in the world only earns that kind of money, what is some like small group going to get off Spotify? So, so that was quite eye-opening, though. So,
I can't believe that.
Yeah, keep buying vinyl. Support the artists. Now, this is one of, I'd probably say, the best game on the Sega Dreamcast. You've heard about is it Shenmue or Shenmue?
I say Shenmue. I've always said Shenmue.
I've always said that. Someone on a forum the other day was like, no, it's Shenmue.
Yeah, no,
having a big debate,
Maybe our Nottingham accent, Shenmue.
So, well, we know that Shenmue 3, the Kickstarter for that happened, that's on the way soon. There has been a lot of talk, though, about Sega looking into remastering full HD upgrades of number 1 and 2.
Currently investigating, apparently.
Well, quite interestingly, though, if you look at this article, it essentially says, you know, they're investigating the idea. They would love to do it, but it's not quite as simple as porting it over to the current platforms. So what they're saying is, one of the main problems with Shenmue is that they had a lot of licensed products in there. Like, if you look at the watch in the game, it's the Timex watch.
I totally forgot about that, yeah. All the in the city, there was, like, you know, branded
Coca-Cola
stuff,
machines and all that. So.
Would it not be quite easy just to kind of, like, replace it all, though? Or, no, then again, I guess they might then get annoyed with them. Like,
well, I think you look at Crazy Taxi and the original on that, you know, that was KFC, and then when they released it.
Yeah, Pizza Hut as well.
Yeah, that had all gone, hadn't it? And even the Offspring music, you know, which changed later on, which wasn't the same without that. But
one tune.
The main reason, you only need that song, you don't need anything else.
That just took me back to about 6 months ago, playing it on Dreamcast with Dan, and spending about 10 minutes looking for that song before we started playing it.
Got to be on. But they are saying, you know, that's one of the main stumbling points, but I don't think it's that big a deal. I mean, I think probably the bigger job is porting it to a new platform. Either they make like a Dreamcast emulator for the current platforms, or they just port all the graphics over and do it justice and actually do a proper full-on HD update. But I think with, a lot of people don't own Dreamcast and they probably know about the franchise and would be interested in playing these games. So I think it would be good to kind of time that around the Shenmue 3 release as well. So, I mean, Shenmue 3 earned 6.3 million on Kickstarter.
People obviously won it.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, when did the original come out? 99 and 2001, so it's been a long time. So it would be nice to see the originals getting some love again, I think, wouldn't it?
Definitely, well. We've got some originals getting love here, which is the Sega's Vault that they just released on Steam.
Yeah, we talked about this, didn't we, when it got released?
Yeah.
So it's essentially all the classic Sega games on their own hub on Steam.
Yeah, and
we've already got 350,000 Mega Drive and Genesis carts, inverted commas, purchased.
Yeah,
because you purchase the cart, don't you, online, and it goes onto like your little shelf in the hub, which is really cool. But yeah, already 350,000. When did that come out?
Yeah, it was only about a month ago, I think. Yeah, it wasn't long ago. But that proves that there is still a massive audience for these games.
You see, I didn't think people would be too fussed about it, because I saw it and I was like, oh, this trailer makes like it's sick kind of thing. Like, this looks awesome. But I was just like, oh, it's just the same games they release on everything. Mm. Like, they had a PS2 collection, they had the PS3 collection, the Xbox 360 collection. It's just everything rehashed every time.
Like, how many times you need to buy Streets of Rage 2?
Exactly. I think I've got about 8 copies of Streets of Rage. I've got about 8 ways to play it at home, kind of thing. But the demand's still there, obviously.
We even recommended a Sega pack about a month ago that was with the Humble Bundle.
Yeah.
And that had quite a few of the titles that they're selling
It's Streets of Rage 1, 2, 3, Golden Axe 1, 2, 3. But obviously the demand is there.
Well, it's interesting, though, because, I mean, if you want to play these games, they're so easy to download them for free and emulate them. Mm. But it proves that maybe, I don't know, do people want to give Sega a bit of love back? Like, oh, we'll pay for the games rather, you know, as a thank you for
maybe
making
if
them.
They see it just there and it's that accessible, they're encouraged more to just go for it. Just go on a mad nostalgia trip, buy all the old games that you wanted, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's there is something to be said about having, you know, the nice game artwork and all that rather than just having a ROM in a folder, isn't there? But I think, you know, Sega have got to look at that and think, right, they probably earn more money off this than they have any of the recent Sonic games that have come out on the Wii U, for example.
Definitely.
Now, we talked about Sega. Let's give Nintendo a little bit of love here. The SNES controller has had an upgrade, and you can stick your phone in it.
I need one of these.
Yeah, this is cool.
I just need one of these.
it's saying that it's to the millimetre, mm-hmm. it's an exact copy of the NES controller.
SNES controller.
Yeah. And the D-pad buttons are supposed to be really good as well, so...
Well, this looks like it's not the British one, though.
It's
is it?
The American one with the Palmer Violet Suites control pad.
always makes you think of that.
That's what they always make me think of. Like, so it's still cool. It's still a SNES controller at the end of the day, or Super NES.
Yeah, for our American cousin.
I hate that. Super NES, SNES, get it right. But yeah, no, it's still pretty cool.
But you know, I think this isn't the only one of these. I think I've seen a Mega Drive one online as well.
Oh, really?
And there's a few of these kind of retro pads where you can hold your phone at the top in a little case.
I really want one. I'm going away on like a really like rustic holiday to Italy at mm-hmm. the end of the year, where like we're just going to be in a house and get drunk for the week and just read and stuff. And it's just like I could really do with, I'm thinking of just like downloading a load of games for my iPad or my iPhone,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and that would be great for me just to like.
Well, that's it. You've
like,
always got your phone on you.
Yeah.
So you can just.
There you go.
Well, to explain what this thing is, it's a Bluetooth SNES controller that, you know, is pretty much a one-on-one replica of the original. Little place on the top where you can put your phone in, and it kind of, you essentially make yourself a little handheld SNES, don't you?
Mm, yeah.
With a bit of software on there. And it communicates via Bluetooth and works with emulators. £24.48 as well.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad at all, actually.
That's not actually too much more expensive than buying an actual SNES controller on eBay.
Yeah, the original.
They go for like £20 or something, don't they?
Yeah, well, it's like, as well, because I mean, trying to play these old games on emulators on your phone with touchscreen, they're like, little on-screen joysticks and stuff.
I've been putting off buying Chrono Trigger for my iPad.
Yeah.
Because of, I really want the game, but it's really difficult to play like an authentic copy of it in the UK.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I'll just buy it on my iPad when I'm on holiday. And the last like three holidays I've been on, I've still not bought it because the reviews are just like, the touchscreen on it just doesn't work well. Like, so something like that would be ideal for it.
Yeah, well, these games were designed for proper controllers,
exactly.
Weren't they? You know,
yeah.
Touchscreen games you've got to make from the ground up, I think, to be anywhere near, you know, usable. Now, going into the history of hacking here, this was really, really big news. When was this, back in the 80s this originally happened?
This was in 1984.
The Prince Philip hack.
The Prince Philip hack, yes.
And that after a few drinks.
What's happened is the National Computer Museum...
Mm-hmm. They're the one in Cambridge.
Yes, yeah. Has been handed some recent documents which reveal more about this hack.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know about it, this guy, Robert Schifrin, he was kind of typing random numbers into his modem,
mm-hmm.
and just to see if one of them worked. And one of them did. So it linked him onto this old system on BT phone system called Prestel.
Prestel.
Linked him to this old system called Prestel. And he was looking at the user accounts.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that had the number 22222222 and the password was 1234.
Oh, yeah, so very secure.
Yeah, so he's like, oh, what's this? And it was supposed to be for the staff. He basically logged onto it and it said, you are now system manager.
Yeah, and he could see everyone's stuff.
He could see everybody's email, including Prince Philip's.
Well, this was, Prestel was a very early, I mean, it was kind of like AOL, but in the early 80s,
yeah.
It was all text-based. And you know, there have been lots of articles that come out about this over the years. So essentially what he did, he got into the Duke of Edinburgh's email account,
yeah.
and apparently there was only a couple of like little pleasantries in there. He didn't obviously use it a lot, but he'd registered for it, and it was just kind of, you know, customary kind of, you know, thank you letters and stuff like that. So it was very early days, like you said, you know, it was mid-80s when this happened. But I remember after that, he did get in loads of trouble, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it did make the headlines in all the papers. So, but essentially after that, the Computer Misuse Act of 1990 came about after that. You know, after all that kicked off and it made the papers and everything, because it was around that time, though, the mid-80s, when hacking was really, really in the news, because, like, War Games was out about then as well.
Yeah.
And every kid wanted to be a hacker. Mainly to go onto the school systems and change your grades, I think, is what everyone wanted to do. But, yeah, when a member of the royal family got hacked, that was kind of big news all over. So
yeah, I'm sure there was a phone system one where someone managed to change part of the phone system so there was free calls. I'll try and look at that for next week. But I remember there was a national hack on the BT system.
Oh, really?
It was, okay. Yeah, worldwide. Like, everyone was shocked.
Just
was...
let Ravi try it first, see if it still works. Now, a couple more stories before we get to this week's guest. Now, I thought this was quite interesting. Have you heard of the Nuon video game system?
I have. I actually know quite a bit about this. It's the DVD console, if you will, if you really want to call it a console. Mm-hmm. Which came out in 2000 when DVD technology first sort of came about.
Interactive DVDs.
Interactive DVDs. Yeah. And, it's sort of like a game console built into, is it Toshiba DVD players?
Yeah, I think that they had a few. There was Samsung as well, I think.
Yeah.
It was essentially meant to be, you know, kind of like the DVD format. Anyone could incorporate it into their DVD players,
yeah.
I think.
And I think it came about from some of the people who previously worked on the Atari Jaguar.
Yeah, well, I think was the Atari Jaguar was the Flare 2 chipset.
Yeah.
I think this was like codenamed the Flare 3.
All right.
Essentially, it was a success to the Jaguar, really.
Yeah.
The same team on it. But obviously, it never really took off, did it?
No, I mean, I've looked them up on eBay and they're like, people want that outrageous amounts for them, like £600-700.
The controllers look pretty cool.
But yeah, I mean, I think it was a bit of a failed console because if you look at the game footage and stuff, it's pretty choppy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, the only way I can explain it is, like, you know when you get these, like, DVDs, these early DVDs, which have, like, these silly games on, inverted commas, like the Dumb and Dumber DVD. It's, like, where you just click on owls and shoot them with the corks. Like, the games are literally like that, like, really choppy, but slightly 3D. But there was one or two games on it which are meant to be quite good. But
I think it says it's got Tempest 3000.
Yeah, yeah.
I was about to say, it was Tempest, which was meant to be really good, I heard. Tempest 3000. It's actually apparently one of the best versions of Tempest.
Yeah.
Is on the new one.
Well, it's essentially the follow-up to the one on the Jag, isn't it?
Exactly, so, and Tempest was like one of the best games on the Jag as well. Mm-hmm. So, but obviously, it depends how much of a diehard Tempest fan you are.
Yeah, to go and buy this system just for Tempest. There's only about like 7-8 games came out on it, I think, in the end.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting, though, because I think a lot of companies have tried this. I mean, it was essentially the idea behind the 3DO was that we just have one standardized platform where anyone could make their own variants on it. You know, wouldn't have to worry about making their own hardware. But this really was, it got to the stage in the early 2000s where everyone was buying DVD players and they thought, well, everyone can have a games console in their home. If we just incorporate this chipset into every DVD player, no one has to go out and buy like a PlayStation or whatever like that. So the idea itself wasn't bad. But the fact is, you know, there was only a few of them ever released. And really, this has started to make, you know, well, the reason I'm mentioning this is there's a nice big thread on Reddit all about it called A Closer Look at the Nuon Video Game DVD System, where this guy's posted loads of information, loads of pictures as well. And I think this would probably be a contender for one of, you know, if not the most obscure game system that I've ever seen.
You see, I think a good contender, well, you know, what it reminds me of and what I'd think would be a good contender is it the Sanyo Nintendo?
GameCube one.
In the 80s there was the TVs which came with a built-in Nintendo,
right?
And on the bottom, like, literally it just had like the way, like, just imagine one of those old school like 80s TVs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like probably like a 14 inch one, and it was just like probably like 3 feet tall because on the bottom it was a built-in Nintendo,
right?
And you could just put your Nintendo cartridges into it and just straight up just play your Nintendo on it, and the controllers, it like had like a little like drop down piece of plastic where you pulled down and it had the controllers in there and they were on wires, and that's what it reminds me of there. But that was a massive flop as well.
I think they had Sanyo. The GameCube one with the DVD that was built in as well.
Well, I remember Amstrad did a PC with a Mega Drive built in, didn't they? The Amstrad Mega PC. And
that,
you had like a cover and you got your floppy disk drive.
Yeah.
You moved it to the other side and there was a Mega Drive.
There's the JVC Mega Drive like video player as well, isn't there? Like, in 96 or something.
I think none of these systems ever worked. So,
none of these took off. So why on earth did these Nuon guys, Nuon, however you pronounce it, in the year 2000 thought, oh yeah, this is a good idea.
Yeah, so if you're interested in very obscure systems, you know, it's a really, really in-depth look at it. So we'll pop a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com. And thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Retro Hour. It will be out again next Friday, downloadable from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, iTunes,
Stitcher,
YouTube,
everywhere. Absolutely
everywhere, and the website, theretrohour.com. Please do vote for us in the podcast awards.
We want to get drunk.
If you haven't done it yet, all the links to that will be on our website, theretrohour.com as well. Right then, this week's special guest.
Yes, we have Mr. Hoffman.
Now, this is going to be a special all about the Amiga demo scene, in particular making music. And right now, just before we get into the interview, we're going to play one of Hoffman's tracks to show just how amazing this guy is.
Oh, yeah, how cool and how kind of commercial his tunes are. They're not this Amiga little kind of section. They're like dubstep, glitch step. You know, he's created his own vibe.
Very contemporary sounding, aren't they? And bearing in mind, this was all made on an Amiga with an 8-bit sound chip.
Yeah, I can load up Hoffman's tracks on my old machine and they play.
So we're going to hear a song from him now, and then we'll find out how we did it. So for the next half an hour on the Retro Hour, all about the Amiga demo scene, Hoffman. And we'll see you next Friday.
What we're gonna do right here is go back, 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 back.
Welcome to the Retro Hour, Hoffman.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Now, well, obviously, recently the Amiga's been all over the news. We mentioned the new Bedroom to Billions movies coming out.
Yeah, there's
Amiga
a big music section on that as well.
There is, absolutely. Now, you know, we thought it might be quite nice to cover a part of the Amiga that's always been very interesting and quite sexy, I may say. The demo music scene, which obviously you were heavily involved with.
Yeah, very much so.
So let's start at the beginning then, Hoffman. What was your first experience with a computer?
Well, it has to be all thanks to my dad, really. He was massively into technology and really into computers. So he was the forebringer of the ZX81 into our household,
nice.
Which was, at the time when I saw it, I was like, this is, I was very little at the time, but I was a bit blown away by this. Computers, I was just completely sold on it completely. And then we progressed onto a ZX Spectrum, but we only ever had the 16K ZX Spectrum. Mm-hmm. So none of the good games worked on it, which is slightly disappointing. And then, gradually progressed onto obviously the Commodore 64, which was obviously a wondrous, an amazing machine, at which I used to laugh all the Spectrum users in the playground at school.
Oh, we're gonna get some hate mail now.
Always the way. Yeah, so playground brawls over that, and yeah, that's where it all kind of stemmed from, really. So
well, you joked about the Spectrum Sinclair rivalry, and a lot, maybe our younger listeners or people that weren't in the UK might not realize, but that was actually proper fierce rivalry, wasn't it?
Oh, massively. Yeah. Obviously they would always go, well, our graphics don't look that blocky, and then I'd say, well, ours are more colorful, but come on, it definitely sounds better, right? There's no denying that.
And it was the rich boys with the C64 as well.
Or it was the kids whose parents didn't love them, bought them Spectrums. I'm joking, of course. But obviously, in those early days when you mentioned the ZX81 and all that, I guess you weren't making music on the ZX81, though.
No, I mean, I didn't really get creative until we got to the Amiga, really. With the C64, I had my Action Replay cartridge for doing various nefarious copies of games from my cousins and stuff, but only really got as far as maybe changing some text in the game or putting some cheats in or whatever. But when I progressed to the Amiga, it's funny actually, because when the Amiga was about around your local town, you'd kind of meet other users and stuff. So I met a few guys like Andy, Ian and Clive and Phil, aka Galahad. They're all Amiga users and stuff. And, we were interested in the demo scene at that point, because we'd seen it all, from all the discs that we used to get. And, at that time, in your little crew, you'd kind of divvy out what little tasks, so one would be the programmer, one would be the graphic artist, and one would be the musician. And I was really into music, and I partly colorblind as well, so graphics was definitely off the table. So so that's kind of, where I fell into kind of doing more creative stuff, really. was when I got my Amiga.
Well, we had Galahad on our show about a month ago, and obviously he was involved in a lot of the big, you know, Amiga piracy groups, like Fairlight, for example. Did piracy and the demo scene go hand in hand?
I think initially, yes, that's definitely the case. But it did really kind of, you know, by the kind of late 90s or mid to late 90s, you could really see that, you know, people in the demo scene really wanted to try and disassociate themselves from the piracy thing. You know, they were really focusing on being creative rather than all of that, you know, because especially when they were going to, you know, progress from their demo scene kind of background into, you know, trying to get a job, you know, obviously trying to be related to that kind of piracy thing is probably not a good thing. So
it's funny that everyone knows the old Amiga pirate groups. You know, I think even in the software industry today, it often sends shivers down the spines when you hear those old crew names.
Yes. It's funny because I think I mentioned there's a new guy that started in the office a few years ago, and I said, "Oh yeah, I do Amiga stuff." I said, "Oh right, oh yeah, yeah, I used to get discs with Skid Row and Cortex on." I was like, "Oh right, yeah, yeah."
I remember a point in the kind of Amiga cracking scene where, you know, the intros would stop becoming really nice intros, and they'd just be copies of other people's intros with different names shoved on them. And I guess that's when all the demo makers left.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Well, you mentioned a good point there. I mean, was a rivalry quite big between demo crews from your perspective?
I think, well, to be fair, I was quite young at the time. So it was a bit, depends. There was quite a egocentric kind of feel to the demo scene back in the 90s. Crews were like, you know, we're the best, and get lost everyone else kind of thing, which, you know, it's completely dropped off now, as far as, you know, the demo scene in this day and age.
There's none of that elite stuff, kind of.
Sorry?
You know, we're elite.
And you're lamers.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing is, because it's dwindled down a lot more these days, then, you know, it's more kind of a motivational thing where you want people to try. But, you know, back in those days, if you released a bad demo, then it, you know, you'd end up being accosted in the disc mags of the time. Like, so.
Which mags did you used to read then?
Mainly Grapevine, which I think was which started off as, it's funny actually, it started off as like a little single screen thing where you'd scroll through, and then it ended up being this behemoth disc mag that came on three discs. But yeah, that's what I used to read. In fact, there was a music disc that we did when we were back in Quartz years ago, which was like, it was a compilation of chip tunes. Like, I wrote a few a few new tunes for it and stuff, but we basically just compiled loads of chip tunes that we really liked onto one disc. Mm-hmm. And it popped up in the disc mags, and musicians were going, "They've ripped off my tunes." And we were like, "Well, we just really liked them, put them on our disc." Like, so there was like, in fact, I think there's two issues of Grapevine where the issue just keeps going on. I was head in hands, like, "Oh God, what have you done?"
You know what? There is something kind of ironic about, you know, a lot of these people that were probably involved in piracy groups complaining about that, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a bit, I think, yeah.
So what was your setup back then? What Amiga setup did you normally work on?
I just had originally it was just a classic A500 with you know, the classic 512K trapdoor RAM upgrade and two floppy drives, until I got my 1200 and then threw a hard drive in that. And the only setup really was just that, ProTracker and a sampler. And that's, you know, and obviously stealing anything you could hear from any record that you could ever get your hands on. So you'd be like, you're just listening to music and go, "Oh, that drum beat's on its own. Quick, 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 sample it." You know. So,
what software would you be using? Like, what, trackers and samplers?
Just mainly ProTracker. I can't remember what sampler software I used to use. I think it was Audio Master, I think it was, originally. Okay, yeah. But then they built a sampler directly into ProTracker. So whilst you're writing your tune, you could just go, "Right, well, I'm going to sample this straight in and then edit it and loop it and fix it all up." So when ProTracker came out with its sample editor, you didn't really need anything else.
I remember the Action Replay cartridge as well. That was quite useful for getting samples, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there was the classic thing that we always say through other mod musicians that I've spoken to, where you know, it's a bit of a faux pas, but we all do it, where we load up somebody else's module and then we clear all the song data, so all we've got is the samples, and then we write a new tune with that sample set. So
that's all I did on the Amiga.
Everyone used to do it. You might as well just admit it, you know.
So did you ever attend any kind of demo and copy parties back in the day?
A couple. One was a demo party, it was just a demo party back then, really. I mean, there was a few games flowing about the place. But the one that I intended and embarrassed myself massively at was my own group's party, which is the Quartz party. And I must have been about 14, 15, and I got really, really drunk and embarrassed myself massively. And it was written in some disc mags, which I did go and dig through recently and decided to never read them again.
What were they saying then?
What were they saying? I can't remember exactly what happened. In fact, I don't remember very much about it other than shouting lots. And then, yeah, it's probably best left under the carpet, I think.
Yeah, we're mega jealous as well, because we wanted to go to all of those old demo parties and get drunk and make fools of ourselves.
Yeah, so I think there was a couple, the Destiny party that I went to as well. I can't remember where that was. What was the other one? Oh, it was the digital party in 96, 97. Which was the last party that Digital did before they obviously disbanded. Yeah, I mean, that was fun. I mean, that was actually the first demo party I ever DJed at, which was quite bizarre. Someone else brought their decks along. We just brought along some tunes. So me and my mate that went with me, when we were just DJing for a couple of hours. No one really took that much notice. You know, it was just kind of background music more than anything else.
But people may not have attended these demo parties back then. They kind of set the scene. What was it like then? What kind of happened there?
It's very different to what it is now. That's for sure. I mean, back then it was, you'd have obviously, graphics and music competitions. I never really did very well back then, which was slightly disappointing. It was still kind of quite an egocentric kind of scene back then. The people that were considered elite, the people that did really well, you just wouldn't try and talk to them if you were a lonely little lamer like I was back then. So,
but essentially, they're reading back about these like demo parties and stuff. I mean, I didn't go to any of them back then, because I think I was just maybe a couple of years just below kind of the age where I could go to them, which was a bit frustrating reading them. But I did used to go through Grapevine and read about the stories. People would do like show reports, wouldn't they?
Yeah. There was I think there was a massive incident at the Quartz party actually where someone had just, because it was in like a function room with a sports hall and stuff, and someone got really drunk and decided to grab all of these demo scene stickers and stick them all over the Skittles alley next door, which you weren't supposed to go into. Things like that did happen.
And a lot of them were held in like schools and places like that, weren't they, as well? And like, town halls and that kind of thing.
To be honest, they still are. It's just that the kind of people that go to them these days are a bit older and a bit less silly to a certain degree.
I think it's the things that were all teenagers back then. I'd read these reports in like Grapevine, and it'd always be like, we arrived there at like 11 in the morning, picked my mates up on the way, we all went to the off license straight away.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I don't think that has changed.
Well, you mentioned DJing at demo parties. I hear you're DJing at the moment at demo parties, and Revision was your last one?
I've DJed there about, I think, every single one so far, actually. Mm-hmm. It all kicked off really at Sundown, which was kind of my re-entry back into the demo scene, because I'd kind of, I think by the turn, by the end of the 90s, I was kind of doing music in ProTracker, but not really involved with the scene and stuff, but kind of gave up on the scene to kind of do DJing and music production and all that kind of stuff. And the guy who runs Sundown, Rory, had seen me DJing in Exeter when we were touring the UK and stuff, and said, "No, I've looked you up. I know who you are. I used to be in a demo scene. Why don't you come and DJ at our demo party?" I was like, "Oh, well, yeah, all right. That sounds like fun. I mean, I like a bit of demo party." And then he also said, "We also have a tracker music competition." I'm like, "Well, I haven't done that for 15 years. I'm definitely up for that." So yeah, so it's that's kind of where it all stemmed from back in 2010. And since I played at Sundown, so kind of they get quite a lot of visitors from other big parties across Europe. And then I kind of got invited to play at Revision, which is the biggest one. It's massive, like 800 to 1,000 people in this massive room for like 4 days. So I played there for the first year, which was really nervous, because DJing to a nightclub is not nerve-wracking. It is, obviously, if you haven't done it that often, but you kind of know what to expect. You know the clientele are probably going to be inebriated in some form or another. But at a demo party, I wasn't sure whether they were going to get what I was doing at all. But it turned out really, really well. It kind of, there's actually a video of it online where you see the first 15, 20 minutes of the set and no one's dancing. And then gradually by the end of the hour, like there's just loads of people on the dance floor.
After so long away from the scene, I mean, did you kind of get rid of all your Amiga hardware then in the late 90s?
I thought I had, but I found it in my dad's garage, which was quite lucky because I didn't really want to kind of, when I first got back into it, go on a kind of emulation tip really. So I wanted to get the old Amiga out. So I kind of built it back into a tower, got a hard drive plugged in and just started using all that. I actually found my old Commodore 64 as well whilst I was there. Nice. It was in a sorry state, but it still works. So
they're like tanks, they are, aren't they?
They are. They're amazing. Yeah, brilliant.
Did you have to refamiliarize yourself with a lot of it then?
It's funny. At first, I think the first couple of tunes with ProTracker, I couldn't remember some of the keyboard shortcuts. So I used like a newer version that had like a little panel for various functions and stuff. But it's funny, actually, kind of the mindset that you have to go into when you're using ProTracker is completely different to, say, something like Cubase, where you can have as many tracks as you want. You can have effects, you know, you can just load it up as much as you want. You kind of have to forward think, well, I've only got four channels here. If I put an echo on something, that's two channels gone. No, I've only got two left. So you kind of have to forward think and also think about how much memory you're using as well. You can't just put loads of massive samples in it and stuff. So
yeah, you've got to get all the sequencing and the blocks correctly.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is incredibly time consuming, especially when you do silly things like I do, which is do side chaining in ProTracker patterns. I mean, I don't know if you know, it's a production trick that you hear a lot in like EDM, modern EDM music, where the sound kind of ducks out whenever the kick's there. Yeah. But you can do it in ProTracker, but it means you have to basically type in about a billion volume commands, which is it's very time consuming, but it's well worth it.
Well, I've noticed you've been releasing some mods, and with your mods as well, I've loaded them into OptiMed. And it does mad stuff when you play it. It goes backwards and, you know, there's rewinds in there and stuff. It's amazing.
That all started actually because of Revision, because I've been going to it for, from the very first one back in 2011, I think it was. And they saw their tracked music competition. I was like, well, I've got to go in with the ProTracker one. And then I think it was the following year I got there and they were like, we're going to show the patterns this year. I was like, well, I'm not prepared for it this year. Like, I can definitely do stuff that makes the tracker do weird stuff. But then the following year was the year I started doing the scratching and the reversing and stuff. And it was really fun to watch that on a big screen in that X aircraft hangar.
Well, you've invented a piece of software alongside Akira, which
yes.
I've always wanted to use for the Amiga, and it's finally arrived. I've always wondered, how's this going to happen? How's this going to work? And it's come out. It's a PT1210, which basically turns your Amiga into DJ decks, so you can change the tempo, you can cut out channels and load modules into there and mix live with Amigas. It's insane.
Yeah, that all... it was funny how that started out. It was... I think Akira he'd loaded the ProTracker source code and was kind of having a bit of a play and posting some stuff on English Amiga board, which obviously if you're an Amiga user, you should definitely be on because it's really helpful. And I saw his post about what he wanted to do. And you know, being a DJ, I was very interested in, well, you know, would this actually work? You know, because the thing is if you take a ProTracker tune and change the BPM, if you've got a drum loop in there, it's going to sound terrible. It's going to mash it up completely. So a little discussion kind of broke out about, and I was just asking, well, how would you calculate this? And someone said, well, you just do this. And then I took the formula and then applied it to the ProTracker replay source that I had and put a basic text interface to it. And we put the formula in and started playing with it. And it was just, my goodness, it just works. We were just amazed. Like we could, even from like the early prototype, you could do a DJ set. Even though it looked awful. but that's kind of how that kind of stemmed from there, really. And we took quite a bit of time getting that together because it was just obviously a pet project for us. And obviously we got, you know, day jobs and things like that. But when Akira got the GUI and the graphics all sorted out for the interface and we, you know, put that together with it, I mean, it really just really set it off.
Well, I used to DJ myself, and coming from vinyl onto that is actually not that bad. And, you know, the beat mixing is not the hard thing for me now. It's finding the mods that kind of fit correctly, because there's so many crazy
problem,
ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you could go through a lot of the older Demo C modules and you know, especially when there's a lot of them got melodic content, it's quite hard to, you know, squeeze them together. But I think if you just, I mean, the thing is that there are so many Pro Tracker modules. I think I did a Pro Tracker seminar at Revision 1 year, and I asked, I think it's Buzz, to do some stats from Modland of how many Pro Tracker tunes there were compared to the other formats, and it is leagues above everything else. There was like thousands upon thousands upon thousands.
Yeah, I think there was like 40,000 or something.
It's more than that.
More than that. Okay. But it's amazing, because these are all tunes and remixes and stuff that the general public hasn't heard, that only a small section of Amiga society's heard, you know.
But to us, yeah, they're anthems, crazy, aren't they?
It's, yeah, like... they're anthems, yeah, to us. It's yeah, it's good, because this software is probably going to bring it out to the general public. I know I've certainly played in a few cafes and stuff and done some sets on PT-1210s.
We've got a little setup, haven't you, with LCD screens and all that rubbish. Yeah, got them, yeah, in a flight case and everything.
yeah, I've got it fully going. It's great.
I did wonder whether it's worth breaking out two 1200s into a new single slimline case with a control surface on top. That'd be quite fun, wouldn't it?
Oh, that'd be beautiful. That'd be beautiful. Yeah. I'd be your first customer.
Well, looking back at kind of your CV, if you like, of groups that you were in back in the day. I mean, Ghost in 1992, Defect in 93, TRSI, Quartz, Destiny,
Focus as well. Focus.
I mean, it reads like kind of, you know, who's who of the demo scene. How did you get into groups back then? What was kind of the process?
Oh, it was quite organic, I think. I mean, to this day, I cannot remember how we ended up. But the first group we were in was, actually, we started our own group in Salisbury, which we were called Scandal, which was a pretty bad name, really. And that was me, Clive, Andy and Ian. And then I think we were at like an ECTS, or, you know, the European Computer Trade Show that they used to put on. And I think we met someone there and just got chatting. They were like, yeah, we're the UK division of Flashing Bytes. So, oh, that's, the name's not very good, but, you know, we'll join anyway. Then that became Quartz. And then obviously I think after that I left, and joined another group, and I can't even remember how that happened. I think that was just a crazy phone call where someone conferenced about 30 people in using AT&T call cards, which is very odd. And you just kind of mill about, you know, if your group's not really doing anything, and the organizers aren't really, you know, pushing anything out, then you kind of, you know, you get a bit cold feet and just kind of, you know, someone might pick up on you, or you might even get, you know, headhunted at some point. I think that's what happened when I joined Ghost, actually. I just got a phone call from the organizer going, I really like your music. Do you want to join our group? I was like, yeah, all right.
I always wondered that back then, how they kind of all communicated and stuff like that. Because I imagine the UK demo scene pretty much kept the jiffy bag industry going around that time.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think a lot of it was, much to my parents' dismay, phone conversations. And obviously back in them days, a phone call to up north was incredibly expensive. And I used to talk for hours, and they got some nasty phone bills.
Did you ever do any online stuff back then, BBSs and all that?
Yeah. I think when I had my first 14.4 modem, nice, and someone showed me how to blue box, I was in. It's a way of, I think that what I used to do actually was, which they still don't know about, which is wait for them to go to bed, then sneak downstairs with my modem and my Amiga after they'd gone to sleep, and then connect to all the US bulletin boards using blue boxing to download and trade stuff. And then obviously, you know, when the sun started coming up, I'd pack it all away and then go to sleep.
Trying to hide the sounds of the modem.
Yeah, I was just, you know, when it dials, you're like, oh, why, no, shush.
Cover it, yeah, I used to cover it with pillows. That
was, so people that might not know what blue boxing is, explain what process that was then.
A mechanism where you used to get free phone calls, where I'm not exactly sure how it worked out, but who worked it out, but essentially... you used to have a piece of software on your Amiga that would send, you'd have like a phone book in it of American numbers, and you pressed a button and it would send a break tone. So you kind of dial an 0800 number, It was the particular 0800 number, so it's free when you're connected to your call. And then the engineer tone would like break the signal and then quick dial your US number and shift the call over to the US. So you just kind of like you get the modem ready, you get everything ready, and then you put your headphones from your Amiga over the mouthpiece, and then break the line and dial, and then quickly grab the BBS software and get that to connect, and then you're in.
But I think back then, because it was kind of, you know, we're all naive and like, you know, most of us were teenagers or kids. And I think there was kind of you were exploring a lot of kind of this digital universe back then, weren't you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. But yeah, I just remember just connecting to a BBS and having this text kind of, it's almost like a game in itself to a certain degree, like a text adventure I suppose you could describe it, where you'd log in, you know, you'd register for your user, you'd log in, and then you'd go and scan the messages, and you'd, you know, scan pages and pages of releases, or you'd, you know, upload some stuff yourself. It's lots of fun back then.
You know, you mentioned obviously blue boxing and, you know, piracy in the demo scene, like we said, kind of went hand in hand. Did you know anyone that got busted back then?
Only one guy that wasn't busted for piracy, but was busted for putting Pritstick over his stamps, which was a stamp faking that they used to do back in those days. Because obviously, you know, posting, the guy was like a local guy that was a massive trader, male trader. So we used to pop over there and, you know, trade like, you know, well, I've got these games. All right, I love those. All right, so you give me some blank discs as well, because that was the commodity was floppy discs back then. You know, if you had plenty, then you're all right. But they used to put, I used to do it as well, like put Pritstick over the stamp. So when the parcel arrived at the other end, the stamp mark that they put over the stamps would just wipe off.
Okay. Nice move.
And what happened to this guy then? Did they just like come to his house?
They basically came to his house and just I think it was written about in a disc mag, actually, one of the really, really early grapevines, if you dig it through. They just basically turned up with a whole load of parcels that they'd stopped because they, you know, obviously, because he was obviously so many going through his house, you know, it's just a standard residential home with all these parcels going to it, and someone just got wind of it, and then I think he just got fined at the end of the day, really, more than anything else.
Well, Hoffman, talking about your current activities on the Amiga, you know, we, Ravi and I were listening to a few tracks that you've done recently before we called you up this afternoon. Honestly, some of the stuff you do with that 8-bit sound chip on the Amiga is absolutely phenomenal. You've even got a genre, glitch hop.
Glitch hop. Yeah, that's it's a bona fide genre, which, again, it's just one of those things where I listen to a lot of dance music across the board, really. You know, I earliest influence, I suppose you could say, is, you know, people like Jar and all that kind of stuff. But when, getting into the dance music scene, I've followed like all of the genres that you can kind of really think of, like jungle, mm-hmm. drum and bass, techno, and all this. And glitch hop kind of popped up I think about 4 or 5 years ago or so. And I was really into it. What I kind of like to do with the Amiga is rather than just kind of writing stuff that sounds like, you know, a mid-90s computer game, is to try and get, you know, something kind of fresh sounding in. So I get I was influenced by this scene and was just like, well, I want to try and make this Amiga sound like a big bad glitch hop tune if I can. Mm.
It definitely has that modern kind of sound and edge, very contemporary.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely what I angle for as much as I can. Yeah.
Do you think the Amiga's chip is, you know, Paul, is perfect for that? Because it's got quite a gritty sound anyway, hasn't it?
It's a friend of mine was telling me about when he was writing jungle music that he was doing like an investigation or research into, you know, why, you know, jungle music in particular was, you know, the drums used to sound so like, you know, chunky and nice, and he found out that they didn't have enough memory on the Akai samplers, or they, you know, it was expensive anyway, so they used to sample stuff at lower rates and lower bit rates, which is kind of that kind of squareness that you end up with the sound kind of gives it like a weird gritty warmth. It's quite bizarre, and it's funny because like you can. Even though there's not really any top end on it, it exists there anyway. It's such a strange little chip, but yeah, it sounds great.
It's crazy, though, that, you know, kind of for many years after the Amiga, or even, you know, when it was at its peak, really, so many musicians actually made a massive effort to try and clean up their audio and make it sound a lot more professional, but now everyone just wants that gritty kind of 8-bit sound again.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. So you get that with, you know, a lot of the chip musicians as well. You see that's kind of... But yeah, it's just, you know, it's like nice. The thing is that even like an emulated Square Wave or an emulated sound chip just doesn't sound the same as you know, you might not notice the difference, but when you look at it in your oscilloscope or whatever, you can really see the difference. You know, those chips have got, you know, massive amounts of character to them.
Emulation's not the same, is it?
No.
it isn't, although unfortunately, I'm a bit of a culprit of using a lot of emulation to get my tunes done these days.
Well, it's quite relevant as well because what is it? Calvin Harris even did his first album with the Amiga, and you know, there's quite a lot of artists. Urban Shakedown did it.
Oh yeah.
One fabulous remix you did was Super Sharp Shooter, the Hoffman version.
Oh yeah, yeah. I found the LL Cool J Alphabet sample, which was I completely ripped off Zinc's idea, but put my own name in it. Yeah,
yeah, that was great. Yeah, and I like that dot mod is killing MP3.
Yes. Oh, he did have some T-shirts of that. We'll have to get some more printed, I think.
Speaking of your mods, are your mods a lot bigger than they were back in the 90s?
Yes, they are, particularly for competitions, because they do silly things like give me a 2 meg limit, which you can't actually, I don't think you can actually reach with the Pro Tracker tunes. Or it's just, I use a lot of tricks to, the thing is, he's only got 31 sample slots, which is really annoying because you run out of those pretty darn quickly when you're trying to write something that big. So I have to kind of put like 3 or 4 samples in one slot and use a little piggyback technique to get to them. But there's I think when we're doing stuff for stuff like the 64K intros or there's a was it the executable music competition at Revision where you know it's a program file, you know, like a demo, but obviously with nothing visual. But you only get 32K, so. I entered that for the last couple of years, and we do tricks like for drum loops. We'll have the individual drums in the file, but then I wrote some code to kind of mix, you know, 4 channels of drums into one massive drum loop. So we're kind of using loads of memory, but there's actually not that much content, and there's like, you know, like little synthesizers and stuff in there that, you know, generate all the sounds for you. So it's kind of it depends on the application. You know, if it's for a competition, then, you know, they give me a 2 meg size limit, then I'm gonna fill it up as much as I can. But obviously if they've only given me 32k, then I've gotta try and think outside the box to make it sound good.
Use every single byte.
Yes, yeah, try to, yeah. I haven't had to do a byte hunt yet, but I've got pretty close to the 32k so far.
So do you have any future plans, any new versions of PT1210 or tunes coming up?
Tune-wise, I'm not sure. We'll have to see what comes out of Sundown Demo Party, which if anyone's interested, I'll just do a little plug if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
Which is running from the 15th to the 17th of July in Budley Salterton in Devon. It's a really lovely party, a beautiful location, like really idyllic, and you should get down there. Definitely, if you've never been to a demo party before, it's a really good one to start off with. It's not too big, it's not scary, everyone's really lovely.
Don't go to the off license on the way.
Well, I think that's par for the course this day and age, but obviously we're a little more sensible these days, I think. I think I'm thinking maybe doing I'm not sure what I'm going to come up with, but it's Sundown. So it's obviously the demo party that kind of rekindled my demo scene spirit, really. So I have to come with something. What that will be will remain to be seen. As for PT1210, we've got a horrific bug that's been hounding us since its release, where it doesn't work on an A500 with an old kickstart on a floppy drive, which I still haven't found out what it is. And it's been pretty spirit crushing. We're going to fire that back up. I think we know what the issue is now. Akira's looking at doing CD32 pad support, so there might be a CD32 version coming out as well.
Nice.
When we can get the time. But I think once we've wrapped that up, I don't think there's much else that we really need to do with it, apart from, you know, a few other features, folder searching and kind of stuff like that. But then I think there's another project that Akira's got in mind, which he hasn't divulged any information about so far, but I think it's going to be something, I don't know what it is yet, but it's going to be something live performance based with an Amiga anyway. So we'll see where that goes.
Crazy to think, though, isn't it? If someone had said to you 20 years ago that, you know, in the year 2016, you're still going to be doing stuff on the Amiga.
Still making mods, yeah.
I couldn't believe it, actually. I mean, you know, I packed up my Amiga years and years ago and then moved to the studio kind of stuff. So to think that I'm even coding on the Amiga as well. I mean, I do coding as a job I do like database SQL kind of stuff during the day, and then during lunchtime fire up my Amiga emulator on my work computer and type out some code in assembly. it's crazy. The thing is, if you're an Amiga user and you were kind of involved in the demo scene, you have that passion. It never really goes away. You may not do it, but if someone kind of, you know, pushes you in the right direction, then you just end up getting the bug for it, really.
What do you think makes the Amiga so special?
Well, it's the last computer with any real soul, isn't it? You know, if you look at all the machines around those times, you know, there's kind of a heart and a passion to those machines. Everything's, you know, after the Amiga was so, you know, the consoles are a bit of a write-off, really, because, you know, you can't get creative with them. You know, they create a hardware base. You can't, you know, unless you're working in a game company, you can't get to them. And at the time as well, it was so elegant in its design, and its hardware was just so ahead of everything else. I think it was the last, you know, the last great mecca of something you could be creative with in your home that didn't cost the earth. You know, do you remember PCs when they really surged near the tail end of the Amiga was still like, you know, over a grand get hands on.
And you couldn't really get down to the metal either, could you?
Amiga,
it was all. Even the simple user would be using Dopus. Transferring stuff, and you know.
I've still got three Amigas here, so I've had to get them for testing PT1210 mainly in DJing, so.
Well, so, Hoffman, you are doing some amazing stuff with the Amiga, and anyone that's not heard many of your productions, I'd implore anyone to go and give a listen to the kind of stuff you're doing on the Amiga these days. Is there anywhere that people can go to listen to your productions?
Yes, if you go to my SoundCloud, which is soundcloud.com/Hoffman, replace the O with a zero. Obviously, don't type all of that in, because you won't get to my SoundCloud page. But yeah, it's Hoffman with a zero. And if you want to hear the Amiga stuff, there's a Pro Tracker playlist in there, but there's also all the other stuff I do with, in the studio, all the break stuff, and pretty much all of it's free download as well. So go there, fill your boots.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.